Now, shall we begin?
A lot of controversy over this entire subject, starting with what an assault rifle even is.
It's not the firearm itself. It's the intent of the person who owns that firearm in harming someone else.
If you ask the GM of Sharpshooters Indoor Range, any firearm can be considered assault.
The assault part takes place. Somebody buys a firearm of any kind and decide they want to harm somebody, then they assault that person with that firearm.
If you ask the state of Maryland, it's anything with a high-capacity magazine. Think AR-15s and AK-47s.
This is 7.62 by 39. That's kind of the AK-47 round.
The state of Maryland banned assault rifles following the Firearms Safety Act of 2013. The Fourth Circuit upheld that ban, saying the Constitution doesn't protect possession of, quote, weapons of war.
A nation of slaves is always prepared to applaud the clemency of their master, who, in the abuse of absolute power, does not proceed to the last extremes of injustice and oppression, wrote Edward Gibbon in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, offering an entirely appropriate grace note to the discussion of what happened this week when, for the first time, a federal court explicitly ruled that the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution does not protect the right of civilians to own firearms that are arbitrarily classified as weapons of war. By upholding Maryland's ban on the private sale and ownership, and of course we're not talking about government possession of the same implements of violence, we're talking about a ban on private sale and ownership of the same, classified as assault weapons, of course, a term of art that really doesn't tell us anything about the nature of the object being discussed, and high-capacity ammunition magazines, which are ammunition magazines carrying 10 rounds or more. In upholding this ban in the state of Maryland, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit decreed that those weapons and those ammunition magazines fell within the category of, quote, weapons that are most useful in military service. That's a phrase derived from the U.S. Supreme Court's 2008 Heller v. District of Columbia decision. Put simply, continued the majority in the Fourth Circuit ruling, we have no power to extend Second Amendment protection to the weapons of war that the Heller decision explicitly excluded from such coverage. In defining weapons of war, the majority opinion focused heavily on aesthetic features of firearms that civilian disarmament advocates will call assault rifles. It also offered a detailed and largely inaccurate discussion of the rate of fire of these so-called assault rifles on the assumption that high-capacity weaponry of that kind is unacceptably dangerous unless, once again, it is in the hands of the state's sanctified dispensers of officially licensed violence. For its part, the dissenting opinion correctly observed that, quote, if the majority is correct that the semi-automatic AR-15's rate of fire makes it a weapon of war outside the scope of the Second Amendment, then all semi-automatic firearms, including the vast majority of semi-automatic handguns, enjoy no constitutional protection, since the rate of fire for any semi-automatic firearm is determined by how fast the shooter can squeeze the trigger. Many gun rights advocates have said that this decision upends or inverts the 2008 Heller ruling, which they had celebrated without giving careful examination to the late Justice Antonin Scalia's clear redefinition of the right to keep and bear arms as a limited and state-regulated privilege. The problem is not that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals misrepresented or misconstrued the holding in Heller. The problem is that the gun rights advocates who celebrated that decision didn't understand it correctly. A large percentage of the American public is content to redefine freedom in terms of those liberties that we are permitted to exercise, once again, in a fashion described by Edward Gibbon in the maxim quoted earlier. Scalia's opinion in Heller is perfectly in harmony with this self-defeating concept of freedom. And it's appropriate that Scalia, may God rest his soul, wrote that opinion, because he was the most reliably authoritarian and consistently liberty-averse member of the court at the time. With an air of regal condescension, Scalia allowed that the Second Amendment acknowledges and protects an individual right to armed self-defense, and then he explicitly limited the extent to which that right could be exercised, and in doing so he redefined it as a state-conferred privilege. We really shouldn't have expected Scalia, or for that matter anybody, in the federal court system to embrace the view that the right to keep and bear arms includes the right of citizens acting either individually or collectively to kill agents of the state when such action is necessary and morally justified. However, any other view of the Second Amendment is worse than useless. And that's certainly true of the view that emerged from Scalia's opinion in Heller. Summarized Scalia at the beginning of his opinion, "The Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess a firearm unconnected with service in a militia, and to use that arm for traditionally lawful purposes such as self-defense within the home." A few paragraphs later, Scalia elaborated just a bit on the implied limitations of the supposed right he described, insisting that previous court rulings effectively limit the type of weapon to which the right applies to those used by the militia, that is, those in common use for lawful purposes. Scalia asserted, "Like most rights, the Second Amendment right is not unlimited. It is not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever and for whatever purpose." Miller's holding, he's referring, of course, to the decades-old Supreme Court ruling having to do with the question of what weapons were protected by the Second Amendment. Miller's holding that the sorts of weapons protected are those in common use at the time find support in the historical tradition of prohibiting the carrying of dangerous and unusual weapons. Here is an axiom that too few Americans appreciate. When government grants a liberty and then restricts the manner in which it can be used, the result is not a right, but a limited and conditional license. The passage from Scalia I just recited inevitably was seen as a license from the court for legislative bodies to enact or fortify laws against dangerous and unusual weapons, such as the scary-looking guns that are ritually denounced as assault weapons. And that's precisely what the legislature in the state of Maryland did and what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has just ratified. There are even more troubling portions of Scalia's opinion that will abet further restrictions on the purposes for which firearms can be used. At various points in his opinion, and I will give specific page citations as I continue this discussion, Scalia brushed up against the radical origins of the Second Amendment. For example, quote, "The Anti-Federalists feared that the federal government would disarm the people in order to disable the citizens' militia, enabling a politicized standing army or a select militia to rule. The response was to deny Congress power to abridge the ancient right of individuals to keep and bear arms, so that the ideal of a citizens' militia would be preserved." The citations in Scalia's opinion are found on page 2 and also pages 22 through 28. The clear implication of that statement is that the ancient right of individuals to armed self-defense includes the right to organize for the purpose of insurrection against a tyrannical government. Scalia revisited that theme while reviewing efforts by George III's government to disarm American colonists, see page 21 of his opinion. Discussing the ancient origins of the right, Scalia notes that the Stuart kings, Charles II and James II, succeeded in using select militias loyal to them to suppress political dissidents, in part by disarming their opponents. That's found on page 19. Continuing in the same vein, Scalia quite usefully admitted that when able-bodied men of a nation are trained in arms and organized, they are better able to resist tyranny. That's found on pages 24 and 25 of his opinion. However, Scalia declined to tease any specific application from that very provocative observation. Although Scalia drew only scantily from the vast body of insurrectionary writings by the Founding Fathers that deal with the right to armed self-defense, perhaps the most notable would be James Madison's endorsement in Federalist Essay No. 46 of direct military action against a tyrannical central government, Scalia does cite some interesting literature of that sort from the mid-19th century, and I will provide you with a few examples when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
We can't buy what the military uses. And that's That's why I say that. I mean, you can't buy what the military uses.
Neither store agrees with the ban.
Well, I don't think it's right. I think everybody should have, you know, the Second Amendment.
I think it's stupid. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Folks around the upstate see both sides.
My husband is in the military, and there's no reason for somebody to have assault rifles for, you know, average citizen. So I agree with the ban.
Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson III of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals is a Reagan appointee. He wrote a concurring opinion in the Fourth Circuit's recent ruling upholding Maryland's ban on so-called assault rifles, and that concurring opinion simply separates sanctimony and self-aggrandizing mock humility. No one really knows what the right answer is with respect to the regulation of firearms, begins Wilkinson. I am unable to draw from the profound ambiguities of the Second Amendment an invitation to courts to preempt this most volatile of political subjects and arrogate to themselves decisions that have been historically assigned to other more democratic actors. The whole purpose of a Bill of Rights, Judge Wilkinson certainly knows, is to put some questions beyond the reach of Democratic majorities, among them the indefeasible individual right to armed self-defense, and also, derivative of that right, the ability of the independent states to maintain the military forces necessary to prevent their conquest by the central government they were creating. That's really the cardinal purpose of the Second Amendment, not to protect the individual right to armed self-defense, because that's something that exists irrespective of constitutions or statutes, but rather to prevent the central government from disarming the state militias in order to prevent the central government from conquering them, and also to prevent the exercise of the delegated powers within the Constitution proper in such a way that it would infringe the individual right to self-defense. For instance, they could not use the power to regulate commerce as a means to infringe upon that right. The ambiguities of the Second Amendment exist only in the minds of those who are ignoring the obvious. The language is clear enough, except for those for whom clarity is something to be avoided. The fact that Heller exempted from legislative infringement handguns broadly utilized for self-defense in the home does not mean that it disabled legislatures from addressing the wholly separate subject of assault weapons suitable for use by military forces around the globe. Disenfranchising the American people on this life and death subject would be the gravest and most serious of steps, quavers Judge Wilkinson theatrically. It is their community, not ours. It is their safety, not ours. It is their lives, not ours. To say in the wake of so many mass shootings in so many localities across the country that the people themselves are now to be rendered newly powerless, that all they can do is stand by and watch as federal courts design their destiny, this would deliver a body blow to democracy as we have known it since the very founding of this nation. In urging us to strike this legislation, appellants would impair the ability of government to act prophylactically. What does that phrase mean, you might ask? The term prophylactically is applied to those circumstances in which the government screws us for our own supposed protection. More and more under appellants' view, preventative statutory action is to be judicially forbidden and we must bide our time until another tragedy is inflicted or irretrievable human damage has once more been done. Leaving the question of assault weapons bans to legislative competence preserves the latitude that representative governments enjoy in responding to changes in the facts on the ground. Constitutionalizing this critical issue will place it in a freeze frame which only the Supreme Court itself could alter. The choice is ultimately one of flexibility versus rigidity, and beyond that, of whether conduct that has visited such communal bereavement across America will be left to the communal processes of democracy for resolution. In all of this, of course, the assumption is that firearms in the hands of the citizenry are uniquely dangerous and deadly, but that the same firearms in the hands of state actors somehow are transmuted into implements of justice. This is something that he acknowledges a little bit further in this utterly fetid concurring opinion. The weapons that Maryland sought to regulate here are emphatically not defensive in nature. If that is the case, why are agents of the government permitted to keep and bear them? If they're not defensive, their only purpose is what? Aggression. A weapon is a morally neutral instrument, a morally neutral tool. It can be used for aggression, it can be used for defense. Wilkinson's collectivist perspective dictates that only when the weapons in question are in the hands of the subject population do they become dangerous. In his ruling, in his opinion in the Heller ruling, the late Justice Scalia actually examined the Second Amendment's insurrectionary roots, although he forged his opinion in such a way as to facilitate intrusions upon that individual right of the sort that the Maryland State Legislature committed and that has now been validated by the Fourth Circuit Court's ruling. Scalia quoted John Norton Pomeroy's 1868 book, An Introduction to the Constitutional Law of the United States, which stated candidly that the Second Amendment would make no sense unless it enables citizens, and I quote, to exercise themselves in the use of warlike weapons. To preserve this privilege, it's not a privilege, it's a right, and to secure to the people the ability to oppose themselves in military force against the usurpations of government, as well as against enemies from without, that government is forbidden by any law or proceeding to invade or destroy the right to keep and bear arms. Again, that's from the 1868 book by John Norton Pomeroy, An Introduction to the Constitutional Law of the United States, in which he sets forth, in unambiguous terms, a perspective on the right to keep and bear arms that is diametrically opposed to that of the agony aunt, Judge Wilkinson. Scalia once again cited that in his opinion in Heller, and it's clear that he was aware of the insurrectionary origins and purpose of the Second Amendment. Passages of this sort are scattered throughout the 67-page opinion and left without significant elaboration. What's even odder is the fact that Scalia, drawing on Joseph Story's immensely influential commentaries, asserts that the free state to be defended by the people under arms is not the individual state they inhabit, as the founders would have understood, but rather the unitary nation created as a result of the Union victory in the war between the states. That's something that Scalia contends on page 24 of his opinion. What Scalia appeared to be saying here is that while the right to bear arms was once associated with the colonial and state militias, that function has been rendered moot by the consolidation of the states into a unitary entity, and that the right does not exist anymore to carry out that function. Since the modern militia is an institution controlled by the central government now for roughly the last 100 years, there's no longer a legitimate right to armed self-defense against the government. At least that seems to be the import of what Scalia was saying in his historical review. And here, Scalia's analysis really was sort of difficult to distinguish from that offered by the dissenting judges in the Heller ruling. They would simply dispense with the right to bear arms entirely rather than paying lip service to it, while denying its chief purpose and even encouraging various encumbrances upon it, as Scalia did. Undoubtedly, some think that the Second Amendment is outmoded in a society where our standing army is the pride of our nation, where well-trained police forces provide personal security, and where gun violence is a serious problem, Scalia concluded. That is perhaps debatable. Is it really? But what is not debatable is that it is not the role of this court to pronounce the Second Amendment extinct. No, it wasn't. Scalia's opinion, to my cynical eyes, suggested that the role of the court, from his perspective, was to placate key elements of the Republican coalition, such as the NRA, while suggesting alternative routes to those who seek the eventual abolition of the right that was once protected by the Second Amendment. Scalia's opinion and the Heller ruling reinforced one of the few effective rallying points for the demoralized Republican Party, which is this year's election is all about the judges, while simply deferring the day when some judge or president would be able to pronounce the Second Amendment extinct, which, in principle, is what the Fourth Circuit Court did this week. I will return shortly.
One issue that always boggles my mind is that the idea that a gun is a defensive weapon, that is a myth. A gun is not a defensive weapon. A gun is an offensive weapon used to intimidate and used to show power. Police officers do not carry a gun as a defensive weapon to defend themselves or their other officers. They carry a gun to be able to do their job in a safe and effective manner and face any oppositions that we may come upon. If it was a defensive measure, why did we lose 55 officers nationwide last year to gun violence? And unfortunately, in just the 2 months of this year so far, we've lost 2 officers to gun violence in the state of California alone. We're asking for reasonable regulations that will help us keep our communities and our officers safe.
Advocates of civilian disarmament loudly insist that only police and military personnel should be allowed to carry firearms. They are quite evasive when they are asked what it is exactly that such people do with firearms, generally taking refuge in vaporous generalities about how the state supposedly exists to protect us, and that these weapons are supposedly defensive in nature. I do think there is something commendable about the fact that Emeryville, California Police Chief Ken James, a very prominent supporter of civilian disarmament, either because of his native foolishness or because of an irrepressible gift for candor, admits that just the opposite is the case. A gun is not a defensive weapon, he said several years ago. James is a police officer, so it doesn't surprise me that he said that his mind was boggled by the description of a gun as a defensive weapon. Like most people in his profession, I suspect that he's in possession of a mind that boggles easily. That is a myth, continued Chief James. A gun is an offensive weapon used to intimidate and used to show power. Police officers do not carry a gun as a defensive weapon to defend themselves or their other officers. They carry a gun in order to do their job in a safe and effective manner and face any oppositions that we may come upon. In other words, it's an implement of aggression wielded by people who embody this murderous abstraction called the state and act in the name of the state's monopoly on violence. His candid assertion of the privilege to commit aggression underscores the wisdom of the arrangement described in the classic science fiction novel by A.E. Van Vogt entitled The Weapons Shops of Isher. That quasi-utopian story depicted a distant imperial future in which the dictatorial ambitions of the ruling empress are held at bay by armed citizens who enjoy a prohibitive advantage over the government's police and military forces. The guns designed by the weapons makers of that distant era can destroy all matter within the range of its owner, and that means that whoever possesses one of our weapons is more than a match for any soldier of the Empress, a weapons maker proudly explains to a time-displaced visitor from the primitive and barbarous 20th century. Understandably, continued the weapons manufacturer, such a potent weapon cannot be allowed to fall unmodified into irresponsible hands. Accordingly, no gun purchased from us may be used for aggression or murder, and that is why no gangster, soldier, or police officer was permitted to obtain one. This novella was published, if I'm not mistaken, about the same year I was born, 1963 or perhaps 1962. The objective of this arrangement was to ensure that no government ever again obtained complete power over its people, explained weapon maker Lucy Rawl. A man who felt himself wronged should be able to go somewhere to buy a defensive gun, one that was indestructible, tuned in such a way that it could only be operated for defensive purposes by its specific purchaser. Because of this, it wasn't necessary that every individual be armed. What counts is that many millions of people have the knowledge that they can go to a weapon shop if they want to protect themselves and their families, and, even more important, the forces that would normally try to enslave them are restrained by the conviction that it is dangerous to press people too far. And so a great balance has been struck between those who govern and those who are governed. And that balance, I suspect, could be described in these terms. The rulers pretend to govern, and we allow them to indulge that fantasy as long as they don't attempt to coerce others into playing along. Certainly, you guys call yourselves the government, go off to some distant precinct of the planet, and indulge that fantasy and leave the rest of us the hell alone. Regrettably, the personal energy weapons of the kind described in the weapon shop of Isher isn't currently available. The advent of open-source 3D printed firearms does suggest, however, that before long it will be impossible for aspiring rulers to impose a firearms monopoly. And that prospect, I contend, should be as heartening to those of us who love freedom as it is horrifying to people who believe that they have the right to rule over others. The idea that government has to exercise a monopoly on the use of force is a standard definition in every political science textbook, in every college, across the length and breadth of the Soyuz. That point of view was most forcefully expressed by Vladimir Lenin, who, in my opinion, is the most influential political theorist of the modern age. I think one of the most forceful and effective refutations of that idea is found in a brief tract published in 1849 by Gustav de Molinari that has been reproduced under the title The Production of Security. And this is available for a couple of dollars from the Mises Institute if you care to get a copy. You can read it in about 45 minutes. My 15-year-old son read my copy of this pamphlet in about 25 minutes this afternoon, and he was greatly enlightened by it. Everywhere, writes Molinari, the production of security began by being organized as a monopoly, and everywhere nowadays it tends to be organized communistically. Bear in mind he was writing in 1849, which is about the time when government police agencies started to pullulate across the United States like poisonous mushrooms. Here is why, continued Molinari, among the tangible and intangible commodities necessary to man, none with the possible exception of wheat is more indispensable, and therefore none can support quite so large a monopoly duty as security. Nor is any quite so prone to monopolization. What indeed is the situation of men who need security, weakness? What is the situation of those who undertake to provide them with this necessary security, strength? If it were otherwise, if the consumers of security were stronger than the producers, which is the situation set out in A.E. Van Vogt's novella, The Weapons Shop of Isher, if the consumers of security were stronger than the producers, they obviously would dispense with their assistance. That's what the proponents of civilian disarmament want to avoid. They want to avoid a situation where Americans are no longer in quote-unquote need of the security service imposed upon them by the government. Now, if the producers of security are originally stronger than the consumers, won't it be easy for the former to impose a monopoly on the latter? Everywhere, when societies originate, we see the strongest, most warlike races seizing the exclusive government of the society. Everywhere, we see these races seizing a monopoly on security within certain more or less extensive boundaries, depending on their number and strength. And this monopoly being, by its very nature, extraordinarily profitable, everywhere we see the races invested with the monopoly on security devoting themselves to bitter struggles in order to add to the extent of their market the number of their forced consumers. I love that phrase, forced consumers, and hence the amount of their gains. War has been the necessary and inevitable consequence of the establishment of a monopoly on security. I want this principle to embed itself in the minds of every libertarian who seems to think that Donald Trump is in some sense preferable to the neocons. The neocons overtly talk about grand global crusades on behalf of promoting democracy and reordering the world according to an ideological blueprint. That's true. Donald Trump is obsessively focused on strengthening the security monopoly of the state over which he now presides. Molinari's analysis, and I think it's irrefutable, dictates that war has been the necessary and inevitable consequence of the establishment of a monopoly on security. Another inevitable consequence has been that this monopoly has engendered all other monopolies. If you focus obsessively on strengthening the security forces of a regime, every other aspect of society is going to be similarly regimented. And as Molinari points out, this conduces inevitably toward communism. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
I am not arguing that there are never going to be uses for private contractors in some circumstances. You are privatizing something that is what essentially sets a nation state apart, which is the monopoly on violence.
Convened. Spoils will be enjoyed. Blood will be shed. The police will survive as they learn to serve true justice.
Government law enforcement is one of the few services, the providers of which claim the supposed right to kill disgruntled customers, or at the very least to treat them as if they were criminals, because they're dissatisfied with the services being rendered. No matter what names are used by the sponsors of the so-called police review boards, they exude the obnoxious odor of communism, complained a National Fraternal Order of Police newsletter published in the late 1960s. The scheme is right out of the Communist Handbook. They don't specify what the name of that handbook was or how they had procured it. This scheme is right out of the Communist Handbook, which states in part, "Police are the enemies of communism. If we are to succeed, we must do anything to weaken their work, to incapacitate them, or make them a subject of ridicule." After the implacable communists have rendered the police weak and vulnerable, apparently, they will seize control of that vital institution, rewriting its mandate to make it an instrument that serves the state rather than the people. Once that subversive process has been consummated, the typical police officer would proudly proclaim that he and his comrades, quote, are bound by our oaths and by our loyalty to the state and to society, to meet force with force and cunning with cunning. We have a government worth fighting for and even worth dying for. Oh, forgive me. That homily on the supposed sanctity of the state and exhortation to kill and die in its name actually came from the pen of Chicago Police Captain Michael J. Schack in his overwrought expose, Anarchy and Anarchists, A History of the Red Terror. That bloated and sensationalistic tome was perhaps the first effort by American police to cast their critics as elements of a monolithic foreign-controlled campaign of revolutionary subversion. It was by no means the last. That book was published in 1889. Shaq's arguments are still being credulously retailed today by those who insist that the state must have a communistic monopoly on security. And that is a subject about which Gustave de Molinari wrote very capably and persuasively in 1849. Molinari, for those of you who are not acquainted with him, was perhaps the most perspicuous member of the circle of French laissez-faire economists to which Frederick Bastiat belonged. They were writing in the immediate aftermath of the 1848 Communist Revolution, and this was at a time when government-operated police agencies were somewhat rare. They were just finding their roots here in the United States, for example. When they saw the situation of the monopolizers of security, wrote Molinari, the producers of other commodities could not help but notice that nothing in the world is more advantageous than monopoly. They, in turn, were consequently tempted to add to the gains from their own industry by the same process. What did they require in order to monopolize to the detriment of the consumers, the commodity they produced? They required force. They borrowed it for a consideration from those who had it. That's how you end up with crony capitalism, be it called mercantilism or be it called corporatism. This is a natural outgrowth of the claimed monopoly on force in order to provide security. Just as the monopoly on security logically had to spawn universal monopoly, continues Molinari, so communistic security must logically spawn universal communism. What he's saying, in essence, is that if you assume that the state has to have a monopoly on security and express it through the police power, you're playing the same game as the communists that you were supposedly opposing. In reality, we have a choice of two things. Either communistic production is superior to free production, or it is not. If it is, then it must be for all things, not just for security. If the government can monopolize the provision of security, why can it not monopolize the provision of health care? How is it that you could say that you want to abolish Obamacare, but you want to fortify the police power of the state? If communistic production is superior to free production, then it must be for all things, not just for security. If not, progress requires that it be replaced by free production. Complete communism or complete liberty, that is the alternative. In the closing paragraphs of this monograph, Molinari sketched out a vision of the free market for security. Let us imagine a newborn society. The men who compose it are busy working and exchanging the fruits of their labor. A natural instinct reveals to these men that their persons, the land they occupy and cultivate the fruits of their labor, are their property, and that no one except themselves has the right to dispose of or to touch this property. This instinct is not hypothetical, it exists, but man being an imperfect creature, this awareness of the right of everyone to his person and his goods will not be found to the same degree in every soul, and certain individuals will make criminal attempts by violence or fraud against the persons or the property of others, hence the need for an industry that prevents or suppresses these forcible or fraudulent aggressions. In other words, there's a need for security, systematized in some fashion. Let us suppose that a man or combination of men comes and says, for a recompense, I will undertake to prevent or suppress criminal attempts against persons and property. That those who wish their persons and property to be sheltered from all aggression apply to me. Before striking a bargain with this producer of security, what will the consumers do? In the first place, they will check if he is really strong enough to protect them. In the second place, whether his character is such that they will not have to worry about his instigating the very aggressions he is supposed to suppress. In the third place, whether any other producer of security offering equal guarantees is disposed to offer them this commodity on better terms. These terms are of various kinds. In order to be able to guarantee the consumers full security of their persons and property, and in case of harm, to give them a compensation proportioned to the loss suffered, it would be necessary, one, that the producer establish certain penalties against the offenders of persons and the violators of property, and that the consumers agree to submit to these penalties in case they themselves commit offenses, two, that he impose certain inconveniences on the consumers with the object of facilitating the discovery and of the authors of offenses, three, that he regularly gather in order to cover his costs of production, as well as an appropriate return for his efforts, a certain sum, variable according to the situation of the consumers, the particular occupations they engage in, and the extent, value, and nature of their properties. If these terms necessary for carrying on this industry are agreeable to the consumers, a bargain will be struck. Otherwise, the consumers will either do without security or else apply to another producer. In other words, the producer doesn't get to dictate the terms, and the producer is not the default provider of this service. Now, if we consider the particular nature of the security industry, it is apparent that the producers will necessarily restrict their clientele to certain territorial boundaries. They would be unable to cover their costs if they tried to provide police services in localities comprising only a few clients. Their clientele will naturally be clustered around the center of their activities. They would nevertheless be unable to abuse the situation by dictating to the consumers. In the event of an abusive rise in the price of security, the consumers would always have the option of giving their patronage to a new entrepreneur or to a neighboring entrepreneur. You can't do that where the government is the default provider of security. You cannot choose your jurisdiction. You live beneath the claimed jurisdiction of a police department, a sheriff's office, or the state police, or the federal police. This is dictated to you by the producer of security, so-called. This option the consumer retains of being able to buy security wherever he pleases brings about a constant emulation among all the producers, each producer striving to maintain or augment his clientele with the attraction of cheapness or of faster, more complete, and better justice. That's why there are between 3 and 5 times as many private security officers in American society as there are sworn government law enforcement agents. People have to buy their own security because the supposed service offered by the state does nothing to protect persons and property. If, on the contrary, the consumer is not free to buy security wherever he pleases, you forthwith see open up a large profession dedicated to arbitrariness and bad management. Justice becomes slow and costly. The police, vexatious. Individual liberty is no longer respected. The price of security is abusively inflated and inequitably apportioned according to the power and influence of this or that class of consumers. The protectors engage in bitter struggles to wrest customers from one another. In a word, all the abuses inherent in monopoly or in communism crop up. Just as war is the natural consequence of monopoly, peace is the natural consequence of liberty. We need peace officers and not law enforcers. Law enforcement is a communist enterprise. It is by no means uncommon to find people who fit within the profile of what I have described as punitive populists to display among their collection of bumper stickers one expressing the resolute determination not to surrender the right to keep and bear arms, and another professing undying support and fidelity to local police agencies, such as, for instance, the now familiar Blue Lives Matter decal, or Thin Blue Line insignia. How long will you halt between two opinions? If you believe in the right to keep and bear arms, you do not believe in the government's monopoly on violence. And if you're displaying a Blue Lives Matter decal, or a Thin Blue Line insignia, you might as well be displaying the hammer and sickle. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com and at the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org. I will be back next week, and until then, as always, doom spiro pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and maybe send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.